Okay, any preliminary questions or issues? I wound up spending a fair amount of, yes. Either at your option. I actually spent a while talking at the 11 o'clock section about this issue, and let me see if I can reconstruct what I said. First of all, you probably all got the email on how to do that if you want to. I'd encourage you, if you have a laptop, to just check it out, see what it's like. And if you're thinking about using it for the exam, by all means, sort of play around with it a little bit just to make sure you feel comfortable with the way it operates. I was asked the question whether you can use spell check, and I don't know the answer to that. I'm trying to find out what the... Go ahead. Okay, so I guess the answer is you can use spell check. But I would just get used to it. It's sort of like Microsoft Word, but you know, just to sort of learn the quirks of it and feel comfortable using it in the process of saving information and so forth. In terms of whether to use it or not, I think, as I've said before, the primary criterion I would use is how you ordinarily compose things. If you ordinarily compose things by writing them out by hand, and then at the last minute you type it up to make it presentable, or that's sort of the last step, then I would just bring a pen by the way, included in your tuition at no extra charge. You will have all the blue books you want. But on the other hand, if your normal way of composing things is at a keyboard, then I would say you'll feel more comfortable. The one-hour exam is not that big of an issue in terms of fatigue, but when we get to the midterm or the exams in December, a three-hour exam, you know, where you're trying to write for 3 hours, for a lot of people it becomes a significant obstacle. So I would say. Each year, an increasingly large number of students use the ExamSoft method, both because I think laptops have become more affordable, more people are instant messaging and otherwise using a keyboard to communicate on a daily basis, so it seems kind of natural to them. And increasingly, I think the people who practice law do so with a computer on their desk. I mean, when I started practicing law, I was used to using a typewriter, and I quickly learned that real lawyers had a, you know, dictaphone in their hand, and eventually I was converted, because only really highly specialized people with these word processors, could operate these complex machines. And so the lawyers, sat there with a dictaphone and waited for the word processing folks to come back with a draft, and then you'd revise the draft. Well, that's, nowadays most lawyers are using a computer on a daily basis to look up information and to draft things so forth. So, again, I mean, I have my own personal preference, and if you're wavering on the fence, I think I would sort of say at least give it a try. Find if you find it compatible, and most people that start it typically stay with it. Some eventually say, it just makes me so nervous, I'm such a terrible typist, it's better for me to write by hand, but I think lots of people find it compatible. Mr. Richardson? Oh, yeah. In fact, we'll even give you the scratch paper. So I know I'm sticking my neck way out there, but No, that's in fact, yeah, that should be no problem. Yeah. Yeah, we provide the blue books. We provide there. If you use ExamSoft, you will get a floppy disk. In fact, that's one of the things. You know, some laptops these days come without a built-in floppy drive, and you need to have a floppy drive to take that disk. But you get that, you record your thing, and then you turn it in at the end of the exam. Yeah. Right, exactly. All you need to bring on Monday, if you decide you want to use your laptop, is bring your laptop, having done the things in the email about downloading the software, registering yourself. I think there's some kind of maintenance thing they want you to do so that your system's up to doing this. Other questions about the mechanics of the exam? Yeah. The computer part will be in the moot courtroom. Handwriting will take place here. And I'm trying to remember, is there a class in here at noon on Monday? So you come in on Mondays, or one day at least that we're here, there is no class at noon. It's Tuesday, okay. All right. Well, then I'll have to just talk to my colleagues about making sure. What I'm thinking we'll do is we'll make the exam 55 minutes so that we'll try to get it started. If you can get here a little bit early so that we'll be ready to actually start the exam at 1, and then actually we'll have until 5 minutes till 2, keep those folks, keep the crowds held back there, and then at 5 minutes 2 you can drop the exam off and we can switch. Other mechanical questions about the exam? Ms. Wisely. Oh, and does it meet here? Ooh, cool. Well, at least it makes the logistics easier that you can leave at 5 minutes till, and you know, we won't have to worry about getting everything done. All these people moved out, all those people moved in. So that's a good thing to know. Thank you. You may want to shoot her later, but yeah. Yeah. Right, and if it's okay, I'll get you out of here by 5 minutes till 2. So, all right. Let me say something. Again, I did this at the earlier section. I sort of like to keep the two sections in a somewhat parallel place, and so I can remember what I've said and what I haven't said. I have a little sort of speech about the exam process, where it fits into the overall scheme of things. And one of the things I think I've said before, just by way of information, is that at the normal time for the Q&A session on Monday afternoon at 4, this coming Monday, I will actually do a session on the exam. I will take a look through the exams, find one that I think is suitable, and then grade it in front of you. Mr. Hall. Well, what I try to do is find an exam that's neither so great that I have hardly anything to improve upon, nor so terrible that it's an embarrassment to the person who's watching being graded, but one where I can point out, gee, here's where this student did, you know, this and this well, and here's why I checked them off. But here's a place in which they said something close, but it really wasn't what I was looking for, or they got it backwards or mixed up, or they left out this or whatever. So you can kind of see the process that I go through when I grade 150 exams. Ms. Montefiore, what's that? Oh, yeah, I'll take the exam number off so that only the person who wrote it will recognize it. And I usually use one that comes off of ExamSoft. That may actually lead many of you to write yours. It's actually, for the person whose exam is graded, it's a pretty pretty informative, because you get this kind of personal attention that's harder to get. But as you know, I assume you all know this, because I said it in my syllabus and so forth, after the when I grade the exam, I have this checklist. If you've looked at the sample answers to past exams, all of them come with a checklist. That's what I use as I read the exam. The checklist is not a mathematical thing. Each box counts, 2.5 points or something. It's, as I've said only somewhat facetiously, it's designed to keep me awake. And after reading, 100 exams answering the same question over and over again, keeping awake is more of a challenge than you might think. But it's actually, seriously, the checklist is my way of sort of looking at the number of issues that the student has addressed in what I think is a reasonably effective way. And it's not perfect. There are times when I don't give you credit for things that you really did cover adequately. There are times when I give you credit when, upon closer inspection, I shouldn't have given you credit. That sort of comes out in the wash in the end. What I do after I finish reading the exam, I look back at the checklist. I have an impression in my mind, is this a strong exam that's on the upper end of things? Is this an average exam? Is this an exam that's got some serious problems with it? Is it a disaster of an exam that I really have to label as such? Is it an extraordinary exam? Where is it in the general scheme of things? Now, that raises the larger issue of the role of kind of comparative grading. And I'm a little bit mixed on this point. That is, as I grade the exam, I bear in mind, first of all, mechanically, I assign a number to the exam, which, if you put a decimal point in it, I'm just too lazy to put the decimal point in, but if you put a decimal point in it, it would be a GPA. So let's say I read the exam and I give it a 30, and this is a question on the midterm exam, the final exam, any question I'm grading, no matter how many points I assign to it, on the midterm and on the final, I assign points to different questions to indicate their relative weight. So there may be an 85-point question and a 50-point question, the total being 135, and that's the amount of time I think you're going to actually spend writing. So the number of points in the midterm and the final correspond to the number of minutes I think you would need you'd want to allocate relative to the other question. But regardless of what points I've assigned to it, I score the exam like this, which means that would be a 3.0 or a B. This gives me a little bit of flexibility, so I can give a question a 28 or a 22 or a 34. That is, a 34 is just slightly above a B+. A 22 is slightly below a C+. Now, as I assign these grades, part of what I'm trying to do is to calibrate them according to the message we give when we hand a person a diploma. When we hand a person a diploma, we say this person has satisfied all the requirements. They've maintained a 2.2 grade point average or above through their law school career. And you could graduate from law school, get your diploma from this law school, and get your diploma, consistently getting a 22 in effect. But that would barely get you a diploma. That's the minimal level of competence. You could even get, you know, you might get a 17 on this exam, meaning a C minus. But it's an aberrational thing, and you do better later on, and in contrast, you do great. And overall, your GPA is, you know, adequate to get a degree. So sort of at the bottom end of the scale, the minimum threshold is, if a student performed like this, do I think they should get a diploma and our blessing to go take the bar exam? Or am I saying, gee, if you continue performing like this, I wouldn't give you a diploma. Now, on the upper end of the scale, we're dealing with a greater degree of enthusiasm. So if I give you a 27, let's say, that's kind of the average, and I don't have this average in mind as I grade individual exams, I'm hoping that on balance when I get to the end, they will average somewhere around this. This is kind of the average GPA. That means your average relative to the other 150 students in this class. As you get above that, I'm saying, you know, a B, a 30 says this is an above average grade. A 34 says this is really superior. I have maybe 12 students out of 150 that get a grade above a 3-4. And that brings up the question about the kind of Darwinian nature of this system, I made the mistake in the summer class. I wasn't quite thinking clearly. And I gave the example of the old joke of two guys who are camping in the woods, and they hear a bear approaching, and one of them furiously starts to put on his shoes, and the other one turns to him and says, you can't outrun a bear. And the guy turns back to him and says, I don't need to outrun the bear, I just need to outrun you. I made a mistake in telling that story because there is a Darwinian aspect to the whole law school experience that it's a zero-sum game. And I want to make it clear, whatever salve for this conscience it may provide, that I have urged my colleagues to no avail. I've urged them to no avail on any number of fronts. But one of the many fronts on which I've urged my colleagues to no avail is that we look for a non-Darwinian method of evaluating student performance. There are systems like, you may have seen the movie, one of my favorite movies of all time, Stand and Deliver, the story, basically a true story of Jaime Escalante, a calculus teacher, an engineer for TRW or somebody, who decided he wanted to teach high school kids. And he takes a tough high school in East Los Angeles and decides that these kids can pass the AP calculus exam. And he drives them quite relentlessly to the point where they learn calculus and they go take the AP calculus exam, and to the surprise of many people, quite a number of them passed. In fact, when Jaime Escalante finished his last year of teaching, I think there were 42 students in his high school that passed the AP calculus exam, which is higher than any other high school in Los Angeles, including all the kids who live in the rich suburbs. But he had an externally referenced criterion. He didn't turn to his students and say, well, only some of you, you know, will be, will, I'll give you this. he would be delighted if all of them, as in Lake Wobegon, could be above average. The problem is, in this law school, as a result of our failure to seek out some externally referenced criterion, and it's not a total pipe dream, there is the multi-state bar exam. The multi-state bar exam could, I think, some version of the multi-state bar exam could be administered to students in law school as they administer the medical boards, I think they're called, in medical school. If you know anybody who's gone through medical school, after 2 years of taking anatomy and physiology and biochemistry and this, that, and the other thing, they take this very difficult exam that they have to pass to move to the next stage, which is essentially their clinical rotation. And there was a proposal by the president of the Bar Association 10 or 12 years ago to do the same thing in law school. Let's effectively take the bar exam after your second year and then do clinical work. And if I could evaluate you, or the school could evaluate you, based on how well you did with that externally referenced criterion, we would be in a different relationship, like a football coach with his team, like Jaime Escalante with his calculus students. I'm not your executioner as well as your teacher. But where I am in this institution is I am your judge, jury, and executioner as well as your teacher. And I think that poisons, quite put it bluntly, I think it poisons the educational environment. And I would do not anything, but I would work very hard to move from this kind of environment to one that didn't have that feature. But since that is the feature that we have, I try to do it as fairly as I can. And I should point out that when I was practicing law, at one point in my actually fairly soon into working for the firm, I was put on the recruitment committee. And so I screened the resumes of the people that we interviewed. And I didn't pay much attention to the GPA on the resume because I didn't know what the GPA from Willamette or University of Oregon or Puget Sound or wherever else that the law school transcript came from. I didn't know what that GPA meant. I was interested in what's the person's class rank. Were they 10 out of 150? Were they, 150 out of 180? That was the relevant criterion to measure their academic success. And so what that means is, to me, is that to the extent that the system is sort of Darwinian by its very nature, I can't improve that situation by anything I do except to do it as fairly as I think I can. Now, I should say at the same time, after this rather depressing little monologue here, that the measurement of academic success is only a small portion of what you, I hope, aspire to as lawyers. And as I screen resumes sitting in my role as law firm, recruitment committee member. I mean, when I did that, I don't do it now. Only part of the criteria, or only one of the criteria, would be how academically successful is this person. I would say far more important to your ultimate success as a lawyer would be other characteristics. Do you have character? Do you have integrity? Do you have stability? Do you have sympathy and compassion and an understanding of other people? Do you have empathy? Do you have the ability to convince other people that you care about them? Those are the kinds of things that will, if you're good in those criteria, you can have a modest amount of academic talent and be a fabulously successful and very effective and very admirable lawyer. It is not to be overlooked, however, that academic success, the ability to take a fact pattern and spot issues and describe them and remember the elements of this thing and apply them and argue to a persuasive conclusion, that skill does affect your success as a lawyer. As I say, of all the criteria, it's a relatively modest one. Another area in which I'm the lone or nearly lone crank among the faculty is that I think we ought to evaluate students on something other than academic merit. If someone asks, well, what about this student from your graduating class? How would you rank that student? We immediately go to the GPA and say, oh, this person is such. If you say, well, how would you rate their, relatively speaking, what sort of character, integrity, empathy? It's, evaluate them on the criteria. Well, we don't know anything about that. We don't evaluate that. Now, we might write letters of recommendation on a basis. Gee, I know this person. They seem, they're whatever. But we don't take the criteria seriously that that I would think we ought to care about as much as we care about your academic success. But as I say, I'm this lonely old crank relative to the wisdom of my colleagues. Anyway, that's kind of where that one sits, and I think, as I said earlier, I have a checklist, and I put the checklist, I try to use that to balance my overall impression. I thought this was a good exam, thought it had some major weaknesses. Oh, but I look back and I see, use the checklist to kind of cross-check or confirm my overall sense, and then I assign it a grade. I also then write comments so that you get a little paragraph or two, depending upon what I think I can help you with. I will explain to you what were the areas. Basically, it tends to be more sort of on the negative side. What do I think you need to improve upon, rather than praising you for the things you've done well. But I hope in those comments I help you understand what I was thinking at the time I graded your exam. Yeah. I don't have a quota as to that level of distribution. I do have a quota with respect to the range, and I can't remember what the range is. It's I believe it can't go below a 2.5. And it can't go above a 2.9, the average. I could give everybody a 2.9. I could give a whole bunch of A's and a whole bunch of, as long as the average was, my freedom is limited only by the fact that the average must be. Now, again, this locks you into a Darwinian world. You may know I'm not a Darwinian on other fronts. That's another story. But I defend this coerced method because it reflects fairness vis-a-vis the teachers within the school. It happens there's only one torts teacher, so you're not advantaged or disadvantaged this year. Lynn Daggett teaches torts most years. It just happens the way the scheduling fell out that she's not teaching it this year. But in your other classes where there are multiple teachers of civil procedure, contracts, or what have you, you would be disadvantaged if one of your teachers had an average grade of 3.1 and the other teacher had an average grade of a 2.4. It's not to be expected that the teacher who assigned the average grade of 3.1 was such a superior teacher, although the teacher might like to think that. It's certainly not plausible that the students were that much superior in terms of their ability, or vice versa, that what would be much more to be expected is one person was in a happy mood, you know, and the other one was a grump. And it isn't to say that either one of them is right or wrong, but to the extent that those discrepancies exist, it puts the students in a pretty tough position because you are justifiably concerned about, have I been treated fairly relative to my classmates? Have I had a reasonably even shot at showing that I'm good at this academic game for what this academic game is worth? And again, I think you kind of have to come to terms at some point with figuring out how important this academic game is, just as you have to make a determination of how important you think lawyering is relative to the rest of your life. You know, there comes a point at which you say, yeah, I could do that and be a better lawyer, but it ain't worth it. This other thing in my life is more important to me, and I will not sacrifice this other thing just so I can get further on the partnership track or get, you know, whatever this next goal is. And I'll still try to be a good lawyer for my clients, and you know, but every day lawyers face the decision, do I spend another 2 hours getting ready for that deposition tomorrow, polishing up this summary judgment brief? Or do I go to my kid's birthday party, or to the soccer game, or to, you know, go to this board meeting that I sit on? And I hope at some point you say, I could do that, but I'm going home. And that's not to say that there's something wrong with striving to be the best, but. But at some point, you kind of have to figure out what is it that I really value and what things have really, what things are worth hanging on to and what things are worth, do I need to jettison so that I can put my priorities in their proper order? Yeah. That's a good question. You know, the numbering system, we haven't talked about the numbering system. Because I was supposed to do this thing and I didn't do it. Thanks. I'll think about this between tomorrow and Friday. I'll figure out what I'm doing. Because you need to get, there's an exam number for the midterm, but there's another exam number for this mini exam. And I was going to do it with Sharon, so you'd fill out a card and then return it to her. And that slipped my mind. Yes, it is anonymously graded. What I was just getting ahead of myself. Have you gotten exam numbers yet for the fall? Okay. So that's the number. That exam number is the one you use for the fall exam in December, which is, that counts 50% of your overall grade for the year. The mini exam counts 10%. The spring exam counts 30%. So the most important exam is the one in December. For that, you will use your exam number. I need a separate number, which the registrar will keep track of, and then the registrar will tell me in December, after I've anonymously graded, you know, number such and so and assigned it a grade, I just assign grades to a whole bunch of numbers and have no idea whose numbers belong to whom. Then the registrar tells me, oh, by the way, this exam number got this score on the mini exam. Now tell me what their grade is for the whole semester. Oh, well, after I've scored the mini exam, I will hand back your exams to you, typically after class someday or some, you know, whenever. My secretary, Sue, and I she'll have half the numbers and I'll have half the numbers, and we just sort of hand them out. So at that point, I can once I've assigned the grade and given the grades to the registrar, then I can find out, oh, you're number 4782, because I'll never know again anything more about 4782 than later on, whatever your exam number is in December, I'll find out, oh, by the way, that person not identified got this. So I can assign grades. It actually works pretty slick, and I really like the anonymous grading feature of it because it protects me as well as it protects you. But I can still talk to you about your exam afterward, and you can show me your exam with the exam number on. I don't care. It doesn't make any difference to me at that point. Yeah. That's a good question. Stay tuned. If you're doing exam soft, stay tuned for an email. And I'm so thankful that you gave me this, because I was supposed to think about this and I didn't. Other, yeah. Yes, you should still do that, because no, that exam number will be good throughout the semester, and we'll work it out with ExamSoft as to there's a solution to this. It'll work. I don't know what it is, but I have it. Other questions about the exam or meaning of life? Okay. As I say, I give you this because I think it's important for you, at least to know where I'm coming from. Whatever. All right. Yes, I will send an email about ExamSoft. I will also send out an email to everybody. That's right. If that's what you have to do. I suspect we're going to do something a little different, because either we'll do it in your I'll work it out. Okay. All right. So now a little bit of causation here before a little Sindel before we call it a day. Can somebody tell us about Judith Sindel and DES and market share liability and all that stuff? Mr. Viviano. Okay. Right. Okay. And why won't that work? Yeah, we're not dealing from a full deck here. Summers versus Tice requires a complete set of defendants, and we don't have that here. So Summers versus Tice, alternative liability, won't work. Okay, we sometimes refer to, having a number of arrows in your quiver, and so the plaintiff keeps stringing a new arrow here to fire away. What's her second arrow? Okay. Also referred to as concerted action, both are referring to the same thing. What's the gist of that theory? Okay. And the example we have of such a case? I think it shows up in a footnote someplace. Is that? Yeah, it's a drag racing example. So that, as in Meet the Parents, when Ben Stiller and Robert De Niro show up, you know, at the stoplight together, and they zoom off. A case where two people, in effect, conspire together, as you say, encourage one another to engage in the tortious behavior, even if you can't identify which one ran over the plaintiff can essentially hold them jointly liable for their joint conduct. Does that apply here? Why not? Okay, so people can do things in a parallel way without doing it pursuant to an agreement. So that, for example, competitors in a marketplace often keep track of one another and do very similar things, but they do so by, and they may consciously imitate one another. One adopts some strategy, they adopt it. You can watch people who sell gasoline. Price goes up, price goes down. They move together. But there's a big difference between doing that independently, even in a way where you're imitating one another, and doing it pursuant to an agreement. If the gasoline prices move up and down pursuant to an agreement, that's a crime. That's an antitrust violation. So the problem here for the plaintiff is she can show similar behavior, copycat behavior, but you can't show an agreement as the origin of this similarity in behavior. So concert of action doesn't work. What's the third theory? Okay. And how does that work? So did they jointly agree to do a tortious thing? So if they didn't jointly decide to do a negligent thing, why are we holding them in effect jointly liable? That's you correctly identified the theory, but I'm trying to understand what. Well, that sounds like concert of action, then. Is it? No. Okay. And the distinction might be, I sometimes refer to this, the courts don't use this term, but I find it kind of helpful and catchy. It's concert of inaction. This is a sort of sin of omission, as it were, that corresponds to, is parallel to, the sin of commission. Just as in concert of action they tortiously agree to do something, in enterprise liability they have a trade association, they decide on a joint advertising campaign, they come up with, you know, joint research facilities to make better blasting caps and so forth and so on. They have this golden opportunity. A reasonable person would recognize the need at that point jointly as an industry to adopt safety standards, but they don't. They drop the ball. And in that circumstance, the court said, a failure to identify an individual member of that industry won't prevent the industry as a whole from being held liable for its failure, negligent failure to adopt safety standards. So again, concert of inaction, as it were, concert of inaction. Or concert of action, concert of inaction. Okay, so can we apply that to the DES cases? Or not? Okay. Two distinctions here. One is that in the blasting cap case, they had this tightly knit group, small number of manufacturers. It was easy for them, in effect, to come up with this. The DES manufacturers, by contrast, were spread all over the globe, way more of them than you could, you know, you'd have a tough time getting them all together in a, you know, a single hotel for a conference. And the other thing, as you mentioned, is even if they had tried to regulate themselves, unlike the blasting cap industry, which did have the power, in effect, to come up with its own self-regulatory standards, the FDA jealously guards its authority over drug manufacturers and, in effect, would have preempted them. So you can hardly blame the DES manufacturers for failing to do something the FDA probably wouldn't have let them do anyway. So that one doesn't work. So we're finally left with this novel theory here, which comes from, what's the name of it? Yeah. And where does it come from? Yeah. The Supreme Court of California, in a very important case, turns for guidance to a law student. What do you think, says the court? And, you know, I ask you the question in the footnote. I mean, does this kind of, is this disturbing? Or is the court giving credit where credit is due? That if you have a good idea, if you've thought this thing through, if you've solved the problem that has been bothering smart people like judges and so forth, why not take advantage of this a better mousetrap? Okay, so how does market share liability work? We get all this cost-sharing stuff, okay? We haven't quite clarified yet how we're going to distribute the liability. That's actually in Brown versus Superior Court. I might add that Brown versus Superior Court addresses another very important issue, which is the standard of liability. How do we determine whether DES is defective, and that we pick up in Chapter 9. But right here, we're worried about assuming it is defective, how do we enforce this market share liability concept? And we'll talk about we'll talk about Brown on Tuesday, but let's leave for a moment the question whether the liability is assigned on individual percentage shares or whether it's assigned to each defendant to pay the whole, joint liability as opposed to individual percentage liability. But what does the plaintiff need to do to even get a market share liability theory on the table? Okay, so you can't just get a little sliver of this pie. You've got to get whatever the court ultimately decides is a substantial share of the entire market. What else do we have to find? Well, again, we could leave it to the, you know, the defendants may have the ability to say, look, I sold none of my product in Washington, and the plaintiff got her product in Washington, therefore count me out. Again, the whole mechanism of calculating these market shares turns out to be a huge quagmire. But just so we know, what kinds of cases can we do market share liability? Could I, for example, do a market share liability of all the people who own blue cars that might have sideswiped the car that's out in front of them? And it has to be a so-called fungible or generic product. That is something where these things are interchangeable. One DES pill is just like another DES pill, different labels, same stuff. It's more difficult to figure out whether that applies. For example, if I repair brakes for a living, I get asbestos dust from all the different manufacturers of brakes. Are those generic? Virtually, are they fungible? Or should we distinguish between those brake linings that have this liner and et cetera, et cetera? And the other thing we have to do here is show that all the defendants were negligent. So again, just like Summers versus Tice, you don't get here until you can say, in effect, all of the defendants, as you were saying, could have been responsible for this because all of them essentially did the same thing. And we've identified a substantial share. So as I say, we'll pick up with Brown and the sort of resolution of the liability issue on Tuesday.